Thank you for joining us for this episode of Journey Now, produced by Journey Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. For more information on Journey Church and our gatherings, visit journeytn.com.
Hi friends, welcome to Formation Friday on the Journey Now podcast. I'm your host, Susie Lind, and today we have for you part two of my conversation with Dave Verhagen. If you haven't listened to part one already, go ahead and press pause and go back to January 29th to give it a listen. Dave shared 3 of 10 principles to keep in mind while talking with people we love who we may not be on the same page as. In part one, Dave shared the importance of being clear on our goal for hard conversations, giving ourselves permission to not talk when we're not ready, and the value of choosing relationship over being right. Here's part two of my conversation with Dave. All right, so we got through 3 of 10. And they're so good. So let's hear, what do you have for number 4? I'm taking notes.
Okay. So if you do have conversations, let me give you just another 3 things that might help you in those conversations, and then we can add some things later.
Okay.
The first, and this is kind of an obvious one, but it's an important one. Mm. And that is, if you're having a conversation, don't make it personal where the person is automatically going to go on the defensive. You are being racist. You are this. You are. Good rule of thumb, we say this in psychology all the time. If you're in a relationship with someone, the more you can make I statements, the better. I feel, because you can't argue with I feel or I believe this. But if you say, you're just being really racist, or you are this, you're immediately starting this interaction off in a way that the person has only defensiveness to come from that. And so I think from a standpoint of just strategic ways of engaging conversation, I have felt really distressed by some of the things that I've heard from you. I want to understand that better. Mm-hmm. I've really wrestled with this. And so along those lines, I'll say, and I do this in therapy a lot, and this is, I don't even think about it anymore, but I did acquire this in my work, is I'm what I would call a big permission asking therapist.
Okay.
I don't just ask a question that's sensitive. I ask permission if I can ask a question that's sensitive. Can I ask you about blank? Can we talk about, is that comfortable for you? So I think that's
that
what I would,
is amazing.
Would encourage you.
Mm-hmm. That feels like a really good way to start a conversation.
Yeah. Be a permission asker, because then they've given you the open door. It's also, there's a cognitive dissonance around, if you say you can ask about this, then it's harder to get defensive about it because you've just opened the door to that. Mm-hmm. But you want to ask it in an authentic way. You want to give them you don't want to just say, hey, can I ask you? And then jump into it. You want to say, please feel free to say no to this, but can I ask you about some of the things that you've posted? Or can I ask you about how you really feel about blank? So ask permission and don't make it personally. And then the fourth one is, I think should be a common sense principle, but it is not. Mm-hmm. And that is, talk in person, even if that's by Zoom or phone, and not in social media.
Yes.
Don't put your comments under their comments. Like there's just, that goes nowhere good. I make it a point. I don't use my social media for any political dialogue, because there's never, ever a good outcome with that. Never. You're either rallying people who are like-minded and getting them whipped up, or you're poking your finger in the eye of people who aren't like-minded. And there's no benefit to that. There's just nothing good. Whereas if you're in a one-to-one conversation like you and I are having, then we can really talk about it. We can read each other's tone of voice, body language, and so on. And we can still be very direct and express, but it's a different thing. Mm. And then the next thing I would say is speak to the deeper issue when you're talking. And so here we're kind of getting at some of the deeper stuff. So I'm going to give you a study. I'm going to drop a little psychology on you again.
Do it. Do it.
This to me is such a fascinating study. I love really clever studies. But this one study, they took 300 adults and they broke them up into groups. And in one group, they said, before they asked them questions about social issues. So they asked them questions about, you know, questions about attitudes toward women, attitudes toward minorities, immigrants, gay people, etc. Mm-hmm. But before they did that, one group, they said, a genie comes down and or appears from a lamp, and it gives you a wish, and or grants you one power. And the power that he grants you is the ability to fly. And then the second group, they said, a genie comes out of the lamp and gives you a power, and your power is that you are completely safe and you're invulnerable to harm. No one can hurt you. Yeah. Then they asked them the social questions. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting is in the first group, when people that tended to be much more on the, and again, I'm not partisan to conservative or liberal, but on the conservative side, mm-hmm. were in the first group, they did not change their view from what would be more traditionally conservative attitudes toward those social issues, toward openness to change. They didn't budge.
These are the people who could fly.
The people who could fly.
Okay.
The people who could fly didn't mm-hmm. budge.
Okay.
They weren't any more open to cultural change. They weren't mm-hmm. any more their view on social issues was still pretty much where you would expect. But the people that were invulnerable to harm and could not be hurt changed significantly, to the point where the more traditionally conservative and liberal were very similar. Hmm. Just that priming alone made the change. So the first thing, the principle that we know, and we've said this before, is for a lot of people, and again, I'm not trying to pick on conservatives because I think there's plenty to pick on for conservatives and liberals, mm-hmm. By my own bias is kind of moderate. But the undergirding for a lot of people who are adopting more, I will say, extreme conservative views is that they feel unsafe. They are fearful. They are fearful that their country is going to be taken away from them, that they're going to lose everything, mm-hmm. that they're going to. And so if in conversation you can kind of speak to that, then you're going to get more traction because you're really hitting the underneath part of the argument, not the top layer
yeah.
and all the smoke and drama up here, but the underneath piece of the motive. Mm-hmm. So that is the more, for lack of a better term, pure motive. But there's another piece that I'll say, and there's kind of a more ugly motive in that can be there too. And this is, I don't know if it's controversial. I know it's not going to be favored, mm-hmm. a statement to say. But there's a concept in psychology called collective narcissism. Mm. And collective narcissism is the idea that a group within the group feels like they are special, feels like they are unique and entitled to special treatment, and that other people outside of the group either don't acknowledge that or that they are actively opposed to that. It is sort of a consensus within the group. It doesn't mean that everyone in the group is a narcissist. It doesn't mean that people in the group all have narcissistic personality disorder. It doesn't mean that. It means that collectively, it's this idea, we're special.
Right.
And other people don't like us because we're special, and and it makes it easy to demonize the people outside of the group. And unfortunately, I think in Christian circles, that's exactly what's happened, is that
yes.
we've become
gross.
a subculture of collective narcissism. That's it. So the more pure motive, kind of to recap this, the more pure motive is someone is reacting in fear and they're not even really aware that how that's happening. But a kind of another piece of this that's an uglier piece is this collective narcissistic piece of we have to circle the wagons and we are special and those people out there, they hate us and they're attacking us and we have now license to kind of demonize and attack and go after them.
Well, I think as I'm listening to you go through these points, I keep thinking, man, it's so important to keep going back to the first one every time and remembering what your goal is. Like, because as a recovering fixer and current shepherd of people, you know, like I'm thinking like, well, if you're afraid, I need to help you get unafraid, you know? And that's not always possible, you know? And so I think remembering the goal and also I would say knowing what is your responsibility and what's God's responsibility and like, what can you do and what can you actually not do and leave it to God? And that, and I'm also reminded of what we say around Journey all the time that like, we trust God in you. And so golly, I mean, if this isn't an opportunity to work out those muscles, I don't know what is.
Exactly. It's really a chance to put feet to this. It's the practical working out of a very true but hard thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we have time for me to hit you with just a couple more?
Yep.
And a couple of these I'm just going to hit really quickly.
Okay.
And then, but there's one I'm going to elaborate on a little bit more.
Great.
So the next principle for me has been to think win-win. And here's what I mean by that. It doesn't mean that you are doing a both sides are right or both sides are the same. It's not that. But I'll give you an example from therapy. If I have a parent come in and they're worried about their kid drinking, smoking marijuana, and the kid says, I want to go up to the lake and hang out with friends this weekend. I'm going to sleep up there. And I'm, you know,
have you been in my house, Dave?
I've been in everybody's house that has a teenager or a young adult. Yeah. After 30 years, it's everybody's house. Right. So it's like, okay. And the parent's like, no, you know, we don't know what's going to go. We don't know those people. We don't know if you're going to drink and drive. We don't know. Mm-hmm. And the kid's like, I'm 17. I should make my own decisions. I'm smart. I know what my limits are. Blah, blah, blah. The whole bit. Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like those two people want different things, but they don't. They actually prioritize different things, but they want the same thing. And this is how I break it down. What does the parent want? The parent wants the kid to be safe and well, mm-hmm. and to be a responsible emerging adult. Mm-hmm. That's what the parent wants. What does the kid want? To be independent, autonomous, be their own person, have fun. Mm-hmm. Those are not mutually exclusive.
Right.
The kid would agree, I want to be safe and well. I want to be someone who's making good decisions for my life. The parent would agree, I want you to become an independent adult who's, you know, your own man and who has fun in his life. So if both people can get what they want, if both people are able to get what they want, then it's a win-win. Now, sometimes the answer to that is if the parent can't get the issues of safety spoken to in a direct way, they still have to be the parent and say, I'm sorry, you can't get up there. But at least opens the door to say, if you can kind of show me how you're going to be safe and you can convince me and we can have a dialogue and a plan, then okay. Mm-hmm. Right. So it opens the door to that. Well, the same thing's true. It's like, well, what is someone, and I'm going to be grossly caricaturing a little bit in terms of positions, but what does a conservative person who's getting all riled up during this time want? Well, they want, a country that they feel like has certain values that are kind of morally grounded, that are where they have opportunities still, that they, you know, we could We could say what they want is not inherently bad. Mm-hmm. What does a liberal person want? They want people who are marginalized, oppressed, to be able to have a voice and to be treated fairly.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So not everybody is going to agree on both those points. The more extremes are not going to agree. Mm-hmm. But in this sort of middle space, that's not even totally middle. It's just on the right and the left. There's a lot of room to try to get to.
Yeah.
Here are the things that you want that are good, and here are the things that I want mm-hmm. that are good. So if you can think win-win, sometimes mm-hmm. you get to a better spot.
Well, and it's funny too, because when you think about even the terms pro-life and pro-choice, mm-hmm. both of those need to be redefined now. Because right. you can talk about being pro-choice and think about being anti-mask and anti-vaccine. Like, those are all people who want choices in how they're exactly. allowed to live. And then yes. you think about pro-life and you think about the people who are for the oppressed and the marginalized more than they focus necessarily on the unborn. But, you know, there's problems in all of it, but it's just evidenced in like the irony of those terms now having to totally be redefined by what we're yes. seeing.
Exactly. And that's
so interesting.
Yeah, it's good. Mm-hmm. So another is to be genuinely curious about the other person. And mm-hmm. back in the 1940s, Dale Carnegie wrote this book called How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yep.
And it was a bestseller throughout the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s mm-hmm. and so on. It's one of the top five best-selling nonfiction books in history because it's timeless and right. it holds up. I have people reading it now that are like, that's a good book. And his underlying principle is, if you want to connect with people, be genuinely curious about them. Mm-hmm. Don't try to find a way in to insert your opinion. Don't try to impress them with how smart, funny, fill in the blank you are, but genuinely approach them with genuine curiosity. So you listen yeah. well, you have empathy, genuine empathy, try to figure out what led them to where they are, like what's mm-hmm. their context, what's their echo chamber, mm-hmm. what's their own psychology. There's way more, unfortunately, in Christian circles, we like to think that our theology guides us much more than it does when to be honest, it's a lot of our individual psychology about mm-hmm. what things where we land, unfortunately, it's often more of that. So be genuinely curious. The ninth, and this is one I'll just elaborate on a bit, and that is realize that people can be biased without knowing it. And here's what I mean. There are some people that are biased and know it and are proud of it. You know, white supremacists, overt white supremacists. That's a
right.
ugly, horrible thing. Mm-hmm. Let's just call it out as what it is. It's a disgusting, horrible thing. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of people, and this is where people get tripped up. Is that there are a lot of people that the idea that they are racist or they're prejudiced makes them bristle and get defensive. Mm-hmm. And yet they seem to be that. And it is very possible that people can be biased, prejudiced, mm-hmm. Without knowing it. And I'll give you two or three bits of information to show that. There's a test called the implicit association test, mm-hmm. where very rapidly you have to kind of make decisions yeah. With pairings of things. And people that you can take the test about attitudes toward people of color, toward mm-hmm. women, toward fill in the blank. And it begins to get at, without having time to deliberate and craft your answer, just your immediate kind of assumptions and associations. There's a study that was done, I believe it was out of University of London. I actually talked to the study author about it, that says that this idea of the Dunning-Kruger effect, Kruger-Dunning, is that the people that are the worst at something often rate themselves as the best at something. So people that like are the worst drivers rate themselves as great drivers. People that are, you know,
yeah.
whatever it is. That's just that's an interesting little phenomenon in psychology.
Well, we see it on American Idol auditions.
That's it, right. It's American Idol audition. That's it. You know, I am the best. They've missed it. You know, these people are idiots. That's Kruger-Dunning right there. So the principle there is that people are often blind to that. That when they did that with the implicit association test, the people that rated themselves as the least racist and biased were among the most. So people don't know it. And here's interesting, a guy named Robert Jones, who's the director of the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, who wrote, by the way, an amazing, amazing book called White Too Long, a book that every Christian should read. Every Christian should read White Too Long. But his own research, and he is a legit researcher, he says that, and I'm going to paraphrase, but that Christians, white Christians, when asked about their warmth and attitude toward people of color, rate themselves as among the warmest. I am, you know, I love black people. And they mean it. Mm-hmm. And then when you give them questions that are about specific racist attitudes, you know, black people are in bad situations because they're lazy, and we should, you know, players that kneel for the national anthem should be fired, whatever it is. They hold the most racist attitudes. What this means is they see themselves as the most warm toward people of color, and yet they have the most racist attitudes. And he said, the argument that people say that those aren't really Christians doesn't hold up, because the more someone goes to church, the more they're involved in a church community, the more racist they are, not the less.
That's very sad.
It's incredibly sad.
That's very sad.
So it is possible for someone to be biased. And what happens is, in these arguments, someone has this idea of, I love black people, or I fill in the blank, whatever it is. I'm very warm. And they have things in their life that demonstrate that, you know, that they may have volunteered at a homeless shelter or any other kind of.
Some of my best friends are black.
Right. Exactly. Right. And they're biased without knowing it. There's a last thing, a little study that came out of Yale, where they showed people patterns. So it might be a row of triangles, and then they showed them similar patterns where one part of it was out of the row, one of the triangles was dropped below the line, or it was churned sideways. And they rated how uncomfortable people felt with that broken pattern. So here's the regular pattern, and then here's the broken pattern. You follow that?
Mm-hmm.
Then they correlated that to people's attitudes and discomfort with people who are different than them. And there was a relationship between how uncomfortable people were with broken patterns and how much they held attitudes of discomfort toward people who were different than them. And so what the point of that study is that people, without realizing it, some people are psychologically oriented where if something is different from the norm, and if the norm is white people, or if the norm is fill in the blank people, when that gets changed, something in them gets very, very uncomfortable. It's not overt white supremacy. It's not philosophically driven. It is more of that back into that amygdala. They feel distressed by that. Even if they on the surface say, I love black people, I love fill in the blank people. Mm-hmm. So the point of that point is people can be biased without knowing it. And we have to be able to acknowledge that sometimes people are very blind to that.
Yeah. And so therein comes the invitation for us to hold space for their journey.
Right.
To show some compassion where they're coming from and where that implicit or unconscious bias was developed in the first place.
Right. And it doesn't mean we excuse it or that we say it's okay. It just, it allows us to kind of, as you say, hold space for that.
Yeah, that's good.
Good. Last thing is, for me, I said this earlier, I kind of already alluded to this, is if I'm going to make a calculated decision about whether to engage someone in a hard conversation, or whether I'm going to make a decision to set a limit on a relationship, it's the filter for me. Part of the filter is whether that's harmful to them. But my bigger filter is, am I sticking up for the oppressed? And by sticking up, I don't mean Am I just going on record? Mm-hmm. I'm being strategic about engaging that person in that dialogue, because that's going to be the driver for me. That's going to help me step into that, because I feel like I have to be actively sticking up for someone or communities that are historically oppressed. But I want to do it strategically. You know, I'm not going to just blow up somebody on Facebook.
Right.
I'm not just going to cut somebody off entirely. But I want to say, all right, this person is in a position where their attitude is potentially hurtful to other people. What is my best way in? But that's the criteria that I use is am I sticking up for the oppressed?
That's really good, Dave. Really, yeah. Really good. You've given us a lot to think about. We will list all 10 of these in the show notes, because they're a lot to think about and lean into. And I'm sure for many of us, there's some will speak louder than the others in terms of our ability to engage with people that we love. But thank you. Thank you for being with us. And thank you for helping us navigate these waters that I'm sure we will continue talking about. Thanks again for listening to this conversation with Dave Verhagen. I hope you are encouraged and equipped to be more loving with the people you've been planted with. Again, part one can be found on January 29th. I know I'm going to bookmark both of these episodes, because the nature of life is that they will come in handy again. Thanks again for being with us today.